This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we heard about how the Smithsonian is using 3D printing and other digital technology to build its exhibitions. Now to an historical museum show in New Hampshire that required some old-school detective work.
Well, my name is Astrida Schaefer, and I'm a costume historian, independent scholar. I have my own business in which I make mannequins for museums to show their historic textiles on.
Okay, so there's a job you may not have known existed. Recently, Astrida curated an exhibit called Embellishments, Constructing Victorian Detail, which is on view at the Portsmouth Athenaeum until November the 6th. The show features a number of striking dresses from the late 19th century, each with its own fascinating backstory.
For me, it is very much being a sleuth. I get presented with an object like this dress, and at times very little information, and I have to examine it and pick up clues and put together pieces and connect the dots to create, recreate, to find the woman inside the dress.
So Astrida Schaefer is something of a dress detective. And when we spoke to her, she told us the story of cracking one of the toughest cases in the exhibit.
The dress is this lovely ribbed silk, so it has a bit of texture to it, and it has a lovely shine to it because it is silk, and it's this kind of weird color. It's maybe pale gray or cream colored. It's really hard to define. It has ruffles, pleats on the skirt. It has decorated sleeves with fringe and intricate pleats on the cuffs. It's quite elaborate. And it looks like it belongs to someone who has a lot of social status.
The dresses on display at the Athenaeum actually come from a textile collection owned by the University Museum of UNH. Originally assembled as a teaching tool for the Home Economics Department in the 1920s, the records that once identified these garments were lost long ago.
So this is an example of this great garment and no information in the files other than a number.
To rediscover the origins of the pale gray dress, Schaefer first had to examine its design.
The first thing I do is I look at the way the bodice is pieced and sewn together, because in the 19th century, you can really date something by the number of pieces that go into the bodice or the top part of a dress. Does it have a center back seam? All kinds of little tells.
With these tells, Schaefer is able to date the dress's construction to the 1870s. But her biggest clue was not in the detail. It was written on the inside of the dress.
Someone had taken ballpoint pen, which is really unusual to do, and written on the skirt waistband, B. Freeman, Somersworth, New Hampshire. Now, that's not something anyone in a museum would ever do to an object. This is, however, something that maybe the owner might have done before handing it over.
And so, armed with a last name and a decade, Schaefer had all she needed to solve the case.
I started searching through inventories, probate inventories, and census records and so on. And I found there was only one Freeman family in Somersworth in the 1870s, a woman named Celestia, who is married to Cyrus. And as it happens, in the 1870s, she gave birth to a little girl named Bessie. So there we go. There's our B and our Freeman.
The process of discovering the owner of the pale gray dress is pretty incredible. Folded into the elaborate designs are a much deeper story about status, identity, and the birth of DIY fashion, because this dress was not bought, it was handmade. And where you or I might only see an old-fashioned garment, Astrida Schaefer sees so much more.
Celestia did not really know what she was doing, basically. There are things like the buttonholes being far too small. The overskirt is just not put together very well. It's kind of, it hangs funny. Some of the pleats on it, especially the pleats on the lovely collar, are one particular kind called a knife pleat. But the very back of the neck has three box pleats, which have a very different structure. And those were supposed to be centered on the back, and she rather spectacularly missed. I mean, they're completely off center. No professional would have made a mistake like that. So things like that are tells that this was made by somebody who didn't really have the technical skills to tackle the dress, but she did anyway.
So why would Celestia attempt such an impressive but ultimately amateurish recreation of high fashion?
Cyrus was a textile mill overseer, which is basically a mid-level management position, not one that afforded him a great deal of money. He was listed as having a worth of $500. And if Celestia had wanted to go and purchase a professionally made garment for herself, that would have been at least $350. There's no way she could have done that. So the only way that she could make herself the woman of status, the woman who mattered, that she wanted to, was to make the garment herself.
So here was a woman who created a dress as an act of transformation. It may not have been perfect, but the gray silk dress marks a unique era for DIY fashion. For many women of modest means, it was the first time that high design was within reach.
You have three things that came together at once. You have the invention of the sewing machine and its entry into the domestic sphere. You have a huge burst of fashion magazines geared toward women that are spreading information from all over the world, the fashion centers like Paris and London, to even the most remote parts of America. And then finally you have the development of commercial patterns. So all three of these work together to hand Celestia this moment where she could create her own identity.
So that is the story told by just one beautiful pale gray dress with buttonholes that are too small and off-center pleats at the back. There are many more on display at the Portsmouth Athenaeum. The exhibit is called Embellishments, Constructing Victorian Detail, and runs until November 6th. You can learn more about the exhibit and its curator, the costume historian Astrida Schaefer, at wordofmouthradio.org. And now for a different kind of museum detective. Producer Ari Erlbaum brings us this profile of the founder of a museum in Portland, Maine, who spends his days searching for clues about creatures that might not exist.
When Lauren Coleman was 11 years old, he watched a Japanese monster movie.
Half Human is the fantastic motion picture record of the search for the mountain creature of Asia, whose name has become a symbol of terror and mystery, the abominable snowman.
The next day at school, he asked his teachers about the Yeti.
And they gave me three answers. They don't exist, get back to your schoolwork, leave me alone. So that encouraged me to do my own research.
57 years later, he's still researching.
This is a mold taken from the footprint found outside the cabin door.
I've slept in a cabin in the Trinity Alps where there was Bigfoot sightings where they would take the antenna on cars and break them off. And I put out peanut butter and hoped that something would come, and it didn't come.
Lauren's research has been a constant in his life. When he was 12, he started writing letters back and forth with scientists and monster hunters. In college, he studied anthropology and zoology. He searched for grains of truth in folklore and interviewed countless witnesses.
It's always been cryptozoology as my out, my way to really get in touch with how much I love animals, how much I love mysteries, how much I think there's really unknown in this world.
Cryptozoology is the study of cryptids, animals that haven't been proven by science to exist. The most famous cryptids are Bigfoots, Yetis, and the Loch Ness Monster. Cryptozoologists take a scientific approach to this tabloid material. They seek proof that cryptids are real.
By measuring the width, the length, the depth of the print, their composite picture described the species as being 9 feet tall and weighing around 1,800 pounds.
During the Victorian times, the main way of proving that a fantastic beast, a creature, a cryptid actually existed was to go out and shoot one. That really is in disfavor nowadays because you might actually be shooting one of the last four or five. Most of the cryptids, we think, have very small breeding populations.
Lauren is now one of the world's most prominent cryptozoologists. He's gone on cryptid-finding expeditions, written books, and appeared on TV shows. 12 years ago, he opened the International Cryptozoology Museum in Portland, Maine.
So you have Yeti material in here. You have the Orang Pindek from Sumatra. a skunk ape, Bigfoot, Sasquatch.
In the museum, there are hairs, fecal samples, and casts of footprints in glass display cases.
And then down at the end, you have lake monsters, sea serpents, mystery cats. You go a little swing around, and you'll see the mapaguari, which are reports from South America.
Artist impressions and fake taxidermies are stacked on shelves. They depict bizarre-looking cryptids of all types.
There you can actually see a dart gun that was used in the 50s to try to get one of the Bigfoot.
Amy and Alan Lewis are visitors to the museum from Rhode Island. They are here for their wedding anniversary.
From an archival standpoint, that's actually really impressive that they have the actual real... I work in a library, so thinking about just in general the collection of ephemera is really... It's actually really impressive.
They soon find themselves face to face with the Bigfoot.
I understand why it says don't touch the fingers, because I really want to. I'm not going to. All right, you have to get my picture before we go.
Oh, yeah, clearly.
I really want to touch that hand.
No.
Okay.
You can.
I'm not going.
Don't touch the hand.
Okay, so you're probably wondering, Bigfoots, sea monsters, aren't those just the stuff of cheesy B-movies? Lauren says that they may exist, but he's pretty sure they're not part of an extraterrestrial government mind control scheme or anything like that.
What happens is that stories get exaggerated because that's what humans do with the unknown.
This is the claw that reaches out to kill.
He tries to keep things scientific. He won't even start investigating sightings or evidence until he does what he calls a psychosocial background check.
We're always very cautious of true believers that every piece of evidence they find is a Bigfoot, a monster. We talk to their relatives, their parents, people they work with, the police departments in some town, and you can very quickly find out, oh, they've been telling tall tales for their whole life, they have a mental health problem, or they're really credible.
Lauren is also wary of people on the other end of the spectrum.
Debunkers. Debunkers come into any situation. It may be a good piece of evidence, but they'll throw it out because they don't, quote unquote, believe in the cryptid.
Lauren points out that cryptozoology has been successful in the past.
The mountain gorilla, the okapi, a giant squid, all of those used to be cryptids. All of them used to be part of cryptozoology, and then they became part of zoology. For the mountain gorilla, for instance, there were tales for over 60 years of these giant creatures, almost like King Kong-like beasts that would go around squeezing to death native women and killing explorers. Slowly, people started trying to hunt the mountain gorilla down, and then it was shot there in the volcanic valleys of Kenya.
Lauren doesn't expect the celebrity cryptids to be found anytime soon. His bets are on a hominid called the Orang Pendek,
which is a little 3.5 feet tall creature in Indonesia. And it's a creature that's been seen often enough. There's good evidence of footprints. There's hair samples. And it actually is in a contained enough area where there's other kinds of creatures that are pretty rare that have been seen and known about.
Creatures like the Orang Pendek hold the same excitement for Lauren that the Yeti did when he was 11.
I keep very young by being in this field. There's new reports coming in. There's new people to meet. There's new researchers that come through here. So it's always changing.
For Salt Radio, this is Ari Erlbaum.
Stay with us for the band most famous for not being famous, an introduction to the Mekons after a short break.